The title of my talk is We Are One People, The Politics of the Fall Revolution Books. Where the slogan We Are One People comes from is quite ironic. It came from a Latin, a poster written in Latin, Gens Una Sumus, that was seen in Sarajevo during the Yugoslav War of Succession, or Secession. Okay. And the Fall Revolution books are my books, The Star Fraction, The Stone Canal, The Cassini Division, and The Sky Road. When I started writing the first of these, The Star Fraction, back in 1987, I had no idea where it would end up, let alone of making it a series, and it still is not a series. The books can, in principle, be read in any order. And the last two of them, The Cassini Division and The Stone Canal, present alternative possible futures emerging from the world of the mid-21st century that I imagined at the beginning. And the way the books are connected is via a technique that with which I began The Stone Canal when I was desperate to find a way to connect the two books, and that is to take a minor character from one book and make them a major character in the other, or the central character in the other. And in a rather similar way, minor ideas, minor themes, small jokes, throwaway lines in one book expand into major elements in another. In each book, the main characters are, in the light of the other books, arguably mistaken as to what's going on. The big picture only emerges from all of them together, and it's only there for readers who like to puzzle out that kind of thing. So I've been asked to give a kind of an account of the timeline of these books and see how they connect to the political themes. The premise under which I wrote it was basically to try to write science fiction in which the science, or one of the sciences, was historical materialism, the theory invented or discovered by Marx. And the question, the historical materialist question in the books, is what if our civilization is in decline and there are no forces within it to arrest that decline and to renew our civilization or replace it? To take an analogy, the Roman Empire rested on a slave population which couldn't reproduce itself. One generation of slaves never had as many slave children as themselves, as it were. So the empire had to constantly expand. And when it reached its limits, it just went into decline. Marx believed that he had detected a similar limiting factor in the tendency of the rate of profit to fall. This law of economics was noticed by Adam Smith, David Ricardo, John Stuart Mill, as well as by Marx. And all of the classical economists worried quite a lot about it. They believed that capitalism tended towards what they called the stationary state, a fairly static economy that wasn't expanding in any way. Marx referred to the same possibility as crisis. Now, there are many countervailing tendencies, of course, to this, and one of them, one of the decisive ones, is that capital, driven by this falling rate of profit, expands into less developed areas where profit rates are higher. And that, according to many Marxist thinkers whose argument I was following here, leads to imperialism and to conflicts between different capitalist countries. Okay, so this future history goes like this. The first future event referred to in any of my books is the election of a radical reforming government in Britain in the year 2015. Which abolishes Britain's rather feudal and, you know, it's remaining as feudal and royal. What's a simple word to explain it? There are survivals of feudal and older modes of production in British society and the British state, and many people in Britain are in one way or another republicans. They believe that that the archaic nature of the British state is one of the reasons for Britain's economic problems and so on. So you have a government that deals with this by abolishing the the monarchy establishing what they call the United Republic. Now, this United Republic confronts instability within and challenges without. Left-wing movements, nationalist movements, green and libertarian pro-technology movements keep it very busy at home. Meanwhile, in the rest of Europe, the Balkan Wars have revived and widened. More and more of Eastern and Southern Europe has got sucked into the disintegration of post-Soviet Russia, referred to as the former Union. That's a perspective which now seems much less likely than it did, of course, at the time when I wrote these books in the early to mid-90s. In 2020, the Germans tried to restore order by launching a war of European integration, a military drive to the east and to the southeast. The conflicts over taking part in this war intensify Britain's existing tensions, leading to a fiercely resisted royalist Hanoverian military coup against the Republic. rather on a less catastrophic scale, rather like what happened to the Spanish Republic in the 30s. That was the vague model in my mind, if you like. Europe's war and Britain's revolution are ended when the US comes into the war under the cloak of the UN and decides finally and for good to stamp its will on the world. Britain, after a brief and brutal and widely popular occupation under the US UN, becomes a Balkanized kingdom and a Balkanized world under a US UN hegemony enforced by American monopoly on nuclear weapons and space-based military forces. This global order confronts a disorderly global resistance, which both in Britain and internationally. In Britain, the final assembly of the Republic's Parliament formally passes its authority to the army of the new Republic, which fights on as the legitimate government, as a guerrilla force. In the Far East, China too has begun to disintegrate, and there's a long, messy war going on between Japan and China. Remnants of the Chinese and Russian armies and fragments of their border territories unite in a neo-communist alliance calling itself the Sino-Soviet Union. There are other more reactionary movements going on which are referred to in the books as the barbarians, the barb, or the green slime. Their social base is among the growing rural and urban surplus populations thrown off by the system's decay. But a contradictory kind of progress continues. Lifespans are technologically extended. Free rejuvenation is available by about 2020. I would like that. But nevertheless, for many individuals, life remains, as Thomas Hobbes called it, nasty, brutish, and short. The infrastructure of space defense allows a margin for eccentric libertarian and other idealists to establish space colonies of a beginning of the process that Juan Miguel described earlier on, building new space settlements in which they can try out different social forms. One of them appears in the first novel in the Star Fraction as New View, which is a kind of utopian commune built out of what are described as abandoned stages and aborted missions. Meanwhile, and that in its turn, eventually, briefly by the middle of the series, gets to the point where space industrialization is actually profitable. However, by the year 2045, policing this whole mess has become too much for even the US and the UN. A successful offensive by the Army of the New Republic in Britain, coordinated with similar insurrections elsewhere, detonates the Fall Revolution, a worldwide overthrow of the New World Order. But as one of the characters says, what we thought was the revolution was only a moment in the fall. The civil wars go on, and so does the gradual but implacable spread of the Sino-Soviet Union, which brings direct democracy and cybernetic socialism to the communities and countries it conquers. America itself begins to break up, becoming another former union, the FU2. And after that, everything just turns to everything just goes downhill from there. It gets extremely messy, and in essence, Western civilization collapses. And there are two possible successors to that Western civilization in the series. The first of them is in the novel The Cassini Division, where the Sino-Soviet Union, after a century of advance during the Dark Age, manages to essentially incorporate the entire world into itself, and they establish what they call the Solar Union, which is a fairly utopian society of space colonies and space habitats and mining the asteroid belt and refining organic material out of comets and all that sort of thing. One of the characters, however, in the books, who turns up through two of them, a woman called Myra, brings about a different possible future. In the Stone Canal, there's a kind of joke or a humorous section where the main character, the narrator, Jonathan Wilde, discovers that his former lover, Myra Godwin, who's an American, who emigrated to Kazakhstan in the 1990s, has ended up as president of a small state called the International Scientific and Technical Workers' Republic, which exports nuclear deterrents. What they do is they do deals with outlaw nuclear submarines and so on, in which they offer deterrence to cities and communities, and in the end, this rather ramshackle system of nuclear deterrence fails. But Myra, even after that, and after the war between Germany and America and so on, she decides that she isn't going to lie down and let the Sino-Soviet Union, these new communists, walk all over her. And she goes on a search in the novel The Sky Road. She goes on a search for people who will help her little republic and help Kazakhstan to stand up. And she finds nothing. She finds no help at all in the West. So what she does instead is she leads a huge migration of people from Kazakhstan and from other parts of the former Soviet Union into the West, into the decadent, vulnerable, defenseless, rich cities of the West, and brings about a different kind of fall of civilization, which in the outcome is something that is neither communism nor capitalism, but a kind of anarchy, a peaceful and federal anarchy. So that's the future history, and that's how the books all fit together. Why did I write them, and what did I mean to say by writing this complicated political future history? I wrote them out of a fury of political frustration and rage at the balkanization of the world and the fragmentation of the left. What I meant to say was that the politics of identity, of nationality, and of other identities gives us the post-civilized world, the world of which post-Soviet Russia is the future, and it doesn't work. How did I arrive at that position? Well, it goes back quite a long way, and strangely enough, the characters and some of the themes of these books go back a long way. They go back to when I was a teenager in the early 70s, reading all the science fiction that I could get, and also reading a lot about politics, radical politics. It seems very strange being in a small provincial town like Greenock, and I was working my way along the library shelves reading all these radical political texts, as well as reading novels like John Brunner's The Jagged Orbit, Future Shock, rubbish like Chariots of the Gods by Erich von Däniken. I'm sure you have there's been several translations in Spanish of these wonderful books. And eventually I discovered Marxism. And Marxism seemed to make a lot of sense. So did feminism. One of the books that I encountered was a book by an Australian-born British feminist, Germaine Greer, The Female Eunuch. And by the time I arrived at Glasgow University and into my teens, I thought that feminism and socialism were all very straightforward, hand in hand, shoulder to shoulder, and they were entirely compatible. So when I left university and went on to do postgraduate studies, I actually joined a small revolutionary socialist group and discovered that they weren't hand in hand at all. In fact, the socialist feminists who were active in the women's movement were being red-baited by radical feminists for being in the same organizations as men. And within their own organizations, within our organization, these same women comrades were attacking other women who didn't make the women's movement their main focus of political activity. And I used to call that red-baiting inside the Red Party. So I came, there was one very funny incident that sort of stuck in my mind, because at that time on the campus, there was a big campaign about abortion rights. I don't know if you know this, but just to fill in the background, in Britain, abortion has been legal since the late 60s. Fundamentally, it is legal, and every few years, some member of parliament will come up with a bill to try to restrict it or roll it back. And that certainly in the 1970s, that seemed to happen with depressing regularity. So we were at one point, it was all hands on deck to build a huge demonstration against this new law. And the person I worked with on the campus was a rather nice radical lesbian feminist. And at a party in some comrade's house where a lot of alcohol was drunk and a lot of dope was smoked, I had a long, serious conversation with her, in which she explained that all relationships between men and women were oppressive and there was nothing men could do about it. And if men wanted to help, they should simply stop having relationships with women. And that ideally, men and women should live in separate societies, if not separate planets. I decided that if that was what feminism meant, it didn't want any support from me, and it wasn't going to get any either. And I sometimes suspect that something like this conversation must have been going on throughout the country, at least in Britain, because that is exactly what all too many people now take feminism to mean, or something like that. Over the years, I've met a lot of women and heard about a lot more who are feminist in every aspect of their beliefs and their attitudes, but who firmly insist that they are not feminists. The reason they give is always the same. They don't hate men. Imagine if the left had taken the most hostile caricatures of what socialism was and what it meant to be a socialist and proceeded to live up to them. Now, you would now have lots of people saying, I'm not a socialist, but I think capitalism sucks and should be replaced by a system based on common ownership and democratic control of the means of production and distribution. But wait, that's exactly what happened. So I began to, I got into a, into fairly fairly boring and traditional left-wing politics after that. But I was interested in the way in which this whole identity business was chewing up left-wing politics, particularly in Britain and particularly in London in the 1980s. And At the same time, in the late 80s, I was getting interested in what was going on in the Soviet Union, its gradual disintegration, and the failure of socialism, which seemed to give a lot of evidence for the argument that only the market can work. Now, I wouldn't necessarily take the same position now, but I read a great deal of essays and articles on that very subject, on free market economics and on what is called in English libertarianism, which means something different from what it means in other European languages. In English, libertarian almost always refers to not anarchists or socialist anarchists, but to what you might call free market anarchists. So that raised a kind of a worrying question. It raised a kind of worrying question because there seemed to be very strong arguments that showed that socialism couldn't work. On the other hand, there seemed to be very strong arguments that showed that capitalism couldn't last, that capitalism did have some built-in problems, which, whether it was Marx's falling rate of profit or some other deep problems identified by Keynes or by the ecologists or whatever, meant that it had a finite and limited future. What if capitalism can't last and socialism can't replace it? That gave me the cheerful idea that, well, if it's going to be either socialism or barbarism, and socialism is out, then barbarism it is. And that's what emerges in these books, the Fall Revolution books. I don't know if I would endorse that now. I don't think it's necessarily the case that barbarism is the most likely future, but it's certainly looking at the prospect and looking at it from the angle of conflicts between people's identities, between nationalities and international identities and so on, gave me a wonderful opportunity to explore a great diversity of political possibilities and to satirize and to lampoon many of the political tendencies of the present. Thank you.
Hola, gracias. Vamos a ver, lo que yo quería es hacer un comentario que un poco unifica lo que habéis hablado los dos, sobre una sociedad utópica en la que precisamente nuestra sociedad actual se encuentra con ella y se encuentra que ellos funcionan de otra manera totalmente distinta a nosotros gracias a que no hay hombres y mujeres, de lo que también se está hablando. Me refiero a La mano izquierda de la oscuridad, de Ursula K. Le Guin. ¿La habéis leído?
Sorry, I had the wrong channel. Darkness. Could you repeat? Could you just repeat all that again? Sorry.
Have you read Left Hand?
No, en castellano.
¿Ahora? ¿Me oyes?
I've got it now. Yeah.
Vale. Vale, gracias. Que si habíais leído La mano izquierda de la oscuridad, de Ursula K. Le Guin, que habla precisamente de las dos cosas que habéis hablado hoy. Una, el encuentro de nuestra actual civilización con una totalmente diferente, utópica en este caso, y además en la que no hay una revolución, digamos, social, porque la puede haber, mejor dicho, gracias a que no hay hombres y mujeres, sino que todos son las dos cosas a la vez en ese mundo. ¿Me has entendido ahora?
Yeah, but which book are you referring to? What book are you referring to?
A La mano izquierda de la oscuridad. Left Hand of Darkness.
Yeah, I've read The Left Hand of Darkness, and yes, it's a very impressive book. I agree it is about these issues, and it's handled a lot more with a lot more sophistication than anything I have ever written. So, yeah, it's certainly relevant to these questions. Is there anything? I'm not quite sure I understand your question, though.
No, es el comentario que unifica un poco los temas de vuestras dos conferencias de hoy. El choque con una civilización diferente y una civilización en la que puede haber un socialismo que funciona y es gracias a que no hay hombres y mujeres, sino que todos son hombres y mujeres en esa sociedad. Sí. Que a lo mejor el problema es puramente fisiológico nuestro de no poder alcanzarla porque tenemos esa limitación física.
Sí, bueno, el libro este es uno de los cinco más importantes, o de los 10, no sé. Sí, estoy de acuerdo contigo y para mí lo más importante, de todas formas, lo que también unifica un poco el tema de nuestras charlas, que es con lo que yo he empezado y a mí me interesa mucho, es cómo la ciencia ficción te permite analizar esas cosas, te permite plantear una sociedad como la que estaba describiendo y llevarla a todas sus consecuencias, o permite analizar la sociedad de sin hombres ni mujeres, de la mano izquierda de la oscuridad, y llevarla hasta sus últimas consecuencias. Al mismo tiempo, entre la ciencia ficción y la ciencia, y esa es la parte que también me interesa a mí más, hay una especie de alimentación. Me interesa mucho también lo que los científicos van diciendo sobre las posibilidades futuras de colonización, y eso también plantea posibilidades de cómo el ser humano se va a ver en ese universo. Pero sobre todo es que creo que la ciencia ficción es una herramienta maravillosa para especular sobre esos temas de un montón de puntos de vista distintos.
There's a book by a more obscure American feminist science fiction writer by the name of Joanna Russ. She wrote The Female Man, which is about men and women, separate societies that are at war with each other. I think the most interesting feminist science fiction for me is not so much about the physiological differences between men and women, but more about the fact that what we consider physiological or biological differences are actually cultural and social. For me, that's a more fruitful question. Y es mi comentario.
I'm like, well, in your talk, you said something like, we're no longer a superior culture, but we still want to be superior. And I was struck by some of the things that you were saying in relation to what, Kevin, you were talking about, what you were talking about in relation to the politics of identity and the fragmentation of the left and a sense of pathos, perhaps, I detected in your kind of description of that, a sadness and when everything was certain. And I really wanted to see whether these two things are actually the same thing that's going on here. That in a way, when you talk about the superior culture, are you talking about a way of life that gave us the idea that there was one kind of template or one way of understanding the world? And here, of course, it's very interesting that we're talking about science fiction, because science as a master narrative within Western episteme as a way of understanding everything in a way and its limits. And then when you talk about the politics of identity, you get the idea that there's some sort of, and maybe I'm wrong, implicit but wrong kind of intrusion into this science fiction, into this master narrative. And so I was just reflecting on whether you still think that there's a desire to be superior is also a desire for re-scientification, and again, when you were talking about colonization and the dynamics of that, there was a question of science. And Kevin, when you're talking about the politics of identity and how they fragment the left, I was just wondering whether there was a certain kind of nostalgia, and in the end, they also fragment the possibility of science and scientific ordering of the world.
Well, Well, I'm you know, by no means an uncritical advocate of traditional liberal or traditional socialist politics, but I do think that the attempt to develop a universal discourse, if you like, related to the idea of a universal class, the working class, was a great attainment, and it fits in quite well with the liberal idea of inalienable human rights. What I objected to about identity politics, as I experienced it in the period of the disintegration of the left, was its reduction of interests to sort of almost zoologically defined, as if the human race had split into separate species, which were all competing in a small niche. And what was actually going on, of course, was simply that different groups of activists were competing in the local state apparatuses for limited resources, and tormenting and haranguing each other and the rest of society with them. Now, I know that's not the whole of, that's a kind of very degenerate politics of identity, if you like, and I obviously don't think that there is one society which is a model, you know, for the world or whatever. I think that the world will, or the world must, if civilization is to survive, become one society and become an integral society, and that the way in which oppression of various kinds should be challenged is from the failure to fulfill the universalist promise, rather than to say that the universalist promise was always false, and that we're left with nothing but different particularisms fighting it out. We can't fight each other in a world with nuclear weapons, so we must love one another or die, as Auden said. I agree, still agree with that.
Bueno, yo es que estaba... Me voy a salir un poquito por la tangente del tema, y porque es que estaba yo rememorando un argumento que he dado otras veces en otras cosas que no tienen nada que ver con este tema, y es que estaba yo rememorando la historia natural. Hay un punto en la evolución de los seres vivos en los cuales aparecen unas bacterias que se llaman las cianobacterias, y en las cuales se produjo un cambio muy curioso, que fue el cambio atmosférico. Al principio en la Tierra no había oxígeno, y a partir de la aparición de estos microorganismos apareció el oxígeno. Este cambio tan pequeño, así a simple vista, que es fundamental para que nosotros estemos aquí hoy hablando, porque sin oxígeno nosotros no podríamos vivir, resultó un cambio en ese momento que fue absolutamente drástico, porque el oxígeno como elemento químico es un veneno corrosivo para la mayoría de los materiales. Y entonces, claro, la mayor parte de los seres vivos que había pululando por la Tierra antes de aparecer la cianobacteria, pues se extinguieron precisamente por la aparición de estos seres. Esto casa con la conferencia en el sentido de que yo estaba pensando que quizás por el mero hecho de que el hombre es como es, está produciendo un cambio en el sistema, en el ecosistema general y en el ecosistema futuro que vamos a tener en cuanto colonicemos Marte, la nube de Oort o cualquier cosa que se nos vaya ocurriendo, porque es el camino en el que vamos, va a dar un cambio que puede que no nos venga bien en algún punto, que es precisamente porque la forma de comportarse de una bacteria es simplemente vivir y hacer cuatro cosas simples, cuatro reacciones químicas, pero la forma de vivir del hombre implica sociedades, implica culturas, implica historia, implica una serie de cambios que le pueden repercutir negativamente al hombre, en el sentido de que toca demasiadas variables en muchos sentidos que le puede venir mal. Y entonces, lo que yo me estaba preguntando es si no será por un mandato innato, es decir, por la propia esencia del hombre, que no podamos avanzar de una forma fácil, que seamos unos xenófobos innatos, que seamos unos machistas innatos, que seamos unos feministas innatos, que seamos unos radicales, innatos en muchos sentidos, y no podamos cambiar eso sin un esfuerzo brutal, sin un esfuerzo contra natura, propiamente dicho. No sé, una reflexión, no era...
Sí, bueno, es eso que dices es un poco el tercer elemento que plantea Bernal, que plantea los enemigos el del hombre, o sea, del el mundo, los planetas. Los planetas son sitios limitados donde lo normal es competir por el poco espacio disponible. La carne, que son las limitaciones de los seres humanos, y los demonios serían esto que tú dices. Es decir, estas cosas nos llevan a nuestra biología y nuestra adaptación a vivir sobre la Tierra, ha creado una serie de demonios que los llevamos con nosotros y que a lo mejor ya no cosas como la xenofobia probablemente tuvieron su utilidad en algún momento, pero ya son cosas que ya no tienen sentido en nuestro mundo, pero que siguen ahí como un apéndice un apéndice psicológico, pero que sigue generando la separación, la balcanización, como decía él, y que lo que plantea Bernal precisamente al final de su que libros como Hacedor de universos, Hacedor de estrellas de Stapleton están basados en sus teorías, y esto es la evolución del, que es un poco también lo que plantea 2001 al final, ¿no? La evolución del ser humano hacia otra cosa totalmente distinta, pero claro, ya no es un ser humano de acuerdo con la, porque arrastramos cosas que nos vienen mandadas por nuestra carne y por nuestro entorno de haber nacido. Lo que propone es que la vida es simplemente la capacidad de transmitir información de una generación a otra. Entonces, lo que plantea es que al final seremos sustituidos por máquinas replicantes y todo esto, pero que no importa porque, a fin de cuentas, son herederos nuestros y es una forma de... Tipler dice una cosa muy, muy interesante en su libro, y es que el concepto de Frankenstein nunca se hubiera inventado en Japón, por ejemplo, porque la idea de los japoneses, el animismo plantea que todas las cosas están vivas, ¿sabes? Incluso una piedra. Entonces, no hay nada antinatural en que un robot tenga alma y piense, y para nosotros es antinatural porque tenemos una tradición religiosa que nos dice que lo peor es la cosa que imita la vida sin ser vida realmente. Pero bueno, a saber si en el futuro seremos hombres, mujeres o solo robots o no sé.
Sí. Hola. Yo quería, bueno, pregunto en español, en castellano, del tema del internacionalismo o la sociedad global que hablaba... que hablabais en la conferencia, claro, yo veo, o con lo que yo había hablado del seminario, es un poco lo que nos interesa la ciencia ficción para conocer el presente, ¿no? Un poco para conocer qué podemos hacer ahora, ¿no? Como un laboratorio de pensamiento, no sé, no político concreto o de cómo usamos la tecnología, cómo podemos plantear otras relaciones sociales, pero ya, ¿no? Entonces, preguntaría quizás un poco, todo, por ejemplo, la campaña global contra la guerra o todos estos movimientos de las sucesivas cumbres, y Ken MacLeod, ¿qué ha pensado sobre eso? Si lo ve como algo relacionado con su obra de ciencia ficción, como la posibilidad de construcción de un nuevo... un nuevo internacionalismo, pero de un movimiento que tenga capacidad de transformación política.
Yes, I do. I think that I think that new movements, new popular movements of very different forms, perhaps to what we've been used to in the past, will arise, as well as a revival of some of the traditional forms of organization, like the unions, and the, both nationally and internationally. So in that sense, yeah, I do think that there is the possibility of a resurgence of what you might call progressive politics in the future, and that to some extent it is taking place today. I took part in the movement against the war in Iraq, and it did manage to create the biggest worldwide demonstration that has ever happened. So I think these kinds of things and the rapidity of communication through the internet and so on is changing the parameters and possibilities. In terms of how it relates to my science fiction, well, hey, I can say I predicted it. that's one thing, but I don't write, or I try not to write propagandist or agitational science fiction. I don't think it's possible to have an easy one-to-one connection between a science fiction idea and a practical political idea. I'm a great believer in that politics is one of the practical arts that people learn by experience, and that utopianism is quite a dangerous thing in politics. So I would rather keep my utopias in science fiction and politics in politics for real life, you know what I mean?
Bueno, buenas noches, mi nombre es David. En relación a la pregunta de José, a los dos autores, de manera especulativa si quieren contestar, o de manera real, muy discutible eso de que la política no utiliza utopía, una utopía negativa, positiva, y la misma idea de política realista pues utiliza mucho cinismo utópico, que evidentemente tiene efectos reales. Me gustaría a los dos autores, si pueden o si quieren, que me dieran su opinión de cuál es la idea que tienen sobre la capacidad del ser humano de dotar de sentido a la realidad y de construir realidades. Y cuando digo ser humano, seres no humanos, o como queráis denominarlo, ¿no? Es decir, desde vuestro punto de vista, situaciones de emancipación, situaciones de reconocimiento, situaciones de interculturalidad, situaciones de proceso, sean políticos, sean culturales, sean sociales, en donde seres humanos o no humanos son reconocidos como sujetos y no como objetos.
Well, I'm not entirely sure I understood quite what you were asking, but I think that recognizing other humans and non-humans of some kinds anyway as subjects and not as objects is a good thing, and that science fiction can help us to do that in the ways that Juan Miguel was mentioning earlier about helping us to, or almost forcing us to see what we as organic human beings might have in common with an intelligent animal of a different species, an intelligent alien, or an intelligent machine, whether built by ourselves or somebody else. I mean, perhaps in the long run, that will have turned out to have been science fiction's major contribution to the future of humanity, because if the aliens ever come, we'll know how to be. We'll know that at least we'll know that they're human.
Sí, bueno, yo creo que la ciencia ficción, tanto como las novelas de viajes imaginarios, creo que lo peor que puede suceder es que el ser humano esté encerrado dentro de una especie de espacio seguro, y podemos ver épocas en la humanidad donde nos hemos sentido seguros dentro de un espacio donde queríamos entenderlo todo y donde pensábamos que ya todo se sabía. Y cuando te abres a otros mundos, como sucedió durante el Renacimiento, y ves otras formas de ver la realidad, y esto siempre crea cosas como la Inquisición y crean respuestas agresivas a esta situación, pero al final siempre lo que sucede es que hay una especie de mejoramiento o de relación entre distintos puntos de vista. La ciencia ficción puede especular sobre esto y especula que esto puede suceder incluso con como ha sucedido en la Tierra, con contactos, por ejemplo, con razas distintas, puede suceder incluso con especies que tengan conceptos bastante distintos y con forma de vida. Pero al fin lo importante es el ser humano y la visión que tenemos de nosotros mismos sobre que no podemos dar nada por sentado ni podemos estar seguros de que estamos en la cumbre de la creación y que no hay otras posibilidades. Y bueno, y siempre se corre el peligro este, ¿no? La ciencia también corre el peligro de asentarse sobre este trono y pensar que todo lo que está fuera de ella no tiene ningún valor. Simplemente hay que estar abierto a posibilidades, y creo que la ciencia ficción permite especular sobre esto. Creo que esto era lo que preguntabas.